This is Kate Harness with 307 Net Radio, and today I'm sitting down with Rose Harriott. Hello, Rose.
Hello.
So we're going to talk about a whole range of things, I hope, but one of the most interesting things that's happening right now is that you're moving buildings and you're cancelling a play therapy centre to the old Goddard and Wages building on Main Street. That's an expansion for you?
It is an expansion. And actually, Jamie Stressler and I will stay at this building. And then I have four clinicians who will be up at Greg Goddard's old building.
Okay. So this building being the one opposite the post office on Main Street?
Yes, at 140 South Main. We will stay here.
Okay, you're not going to move?
I'm not moving.
A big upheaval, okay. So what is counselling and play therapy? What actually happens and who's it for?
So our practice encompasses helping people across the lifespan. We do specialize in working with children. Everyone who works with children in our offices, we are all highly trained clinicians who have done postgraduate work for generally at least 5 to 7 years in the study of play. And play is the language of children. So the child comes in and plays and loves coming to therapy, but they automatically express the issues, the concerns, their anxieties, difficulties in their lives through their play and the toys they choose. And we co-play with the child, who is the director of the play, and the therapist plays with the child and responds back with therapeutic responses. And those therapeutic responses do things like build self-esteem, build value and self-worth, help children overcome their issues by instilling power and control, which is a huge issue for young children especially. And we also help rebuild their nurturing. So if a child somehow has missed an element of their development, either through there could be a divorce in the family or a crisis in the family, anything like that that has happened where a child has missed something, they are able to regress, go back to that. And with our therapeutic responses and our help, they can then sort of make up that time period they missed and then go forward in their development appropriately.
So what sort of children benefit from this? I mean, is it just kids who've been through a crisis? Is it any child? Who are you hoping that, you know, you'll be able to provide services for?
Well, we provide services for a huge range of issues. Everything from physical and sexual and emotional abuse at the extremes to helping children cope with their family splitting up during divorce. We also help children who have struggles at school, peer struggles, academic struggles, maybe children who feel like they don't fit in or they're having behavior issues at school. And so the play element, which is for children from about 2 to 10 or 2 to 12, those children, it can be any child that just seems like they're having some kind of difficulty.
So do they get referred to you? How do you find, or how do your clients come to you? How do you connect with them?
We do get referrals from the Department of Family Services and the schools, but a lot of it is word of mouth. Parents talk to other parents about the successes their children have had. And so people don't need a referral. They can simply call us and get their child in for counseling.
And so one thing we're in, you know, most people right now are experiencing a bit of a financial pinch, and there's a sign that doesn't look like it's going to change anytime quickly. How do you pay for this, and is it expensive?
Yes. So we take almost all the insurances that are used in this region of Wyoming, And we also accept Medicaid. And we also work with families who maybe don't have those insurances. We will help people apply for Medicaid if they need that help. But even in the in-between people, we always work on a sliding fee, a negotiated fee. And so our goal is to make it affordable so that everyone can have access to good mental health care.
Okay. So how long do you think, I mean, it's a unfair question because it's a sort of how long is a piece of string question, but how long typically do you like to have a relationship with an individual child or client? Do they sort of progress out? Is that a success? What happens?
Yes. So a lot of times what happens is the issue becomes resolved for the child. And that is, of course, on that child's timeline. That is also supported by the family at home and the schools. And so that child can progress and kind of graduate out of the program because they've learned how to resolve those issues. And one thing that's really interesting is over the 20 years that we've been doing this, we will work with young children. They will do really well and they will go off and live their life. And then maybe 5 years later, the mom or dad will call back and say, oh, I think, you know, so-and-so needs to come back in for a tune-up. And so I've seen people who are now grown adults that I worked with as children, and they just can kind of pop in and out as they need to across the lifespan.
So it's not, although play therapy is very much aimed at children, you also provide, you have a practice that's for adults of any age as well?
Yes. In fact, with our new expansion up at Goddard's office, we have a very seasoned clinician there who would be, or who is outstanding at working with older adults, senior citizens, and really any adult of any age. That's really her specialty, and her name's Adeline Wilson. And of course, we are very kid and teenage centered. So we have lots of clinicians who see teens as well as the play therapy children.
Okay. So you have a great job. You get to go to toy stores and buy toys in a totally different way than the rest of us approach it. What are you looking for when you are looking for a toy? What is it that kind of you think will actually help you trigger the response that's going to help you with the therapeutic response?
Well, it is quite an addiction to buy toys. It's the most fun. But for play therapy, toys are selected, not just collected. And so we have themes of toys that we address in the playroom. So we will have toys of power and control, and those might be swords for sword fighting or guns or, you know, whatever a child can have some power with. And we also do nurturing, value and self-worth. We have soothing toys, and that would include painting and sand. We have family situational toys, so we have a dollhouse, and then we have toys of mastery, which might include some types of games and Legos and cooking. And it really, all of these toys are available, but the most important toy in the playroom is the trained therapist. Because with the trained therapist, a child can enter the fantasy play they need to accomplish, whatever their issue is.
So the child directs the play, and you interpret what it is you are seeing from that play and how to help therapeutically with the issues that are being presented by that child, whether they're behavioral or whatever they are.
Exactly. And so I'll just give an example. Let's say that we have a child who has a lot of behavior issues at school. When that child comes to the playroom, most commonly, that child will gravitate to the toys of power and control because they're lacking that in their lives, which is why that is one reason kids act out. And so they engage us in the play and tell us how to play. And we can help them get a sense within themselves of their own power and control so they don't have to try to extract it from their environment in negative ways.
And a session lasts an hour. You get to play all day, but not really play. You work to play. You play to work. I'm not sure which way around it is. But.
That's exactly right. The sessions last about 50 minutes, and children just really look forward to their time here. For most children, it is the first time they've really built a relationship all on their own without any, you know, parents or teachers there to help them. And they get great satisfaction in that as well. And we really become a good unit to work together.
So how do you manage the needs of the confidentiality of your client, the child, with what the parent or the guardian or whoever's home they're living in, how do you manage that relationship?
So what we like to do is, if we see, let's say that we see a lack of nurturing, or a child who is expressing they need more nurturing, or they've missed something in their nurturing as they developed, then we consult with the parent and we come up with some ideas that would fit the needs of the child with the abilities of the parents. So it may be something like, let's go back and rock the child 10 minutes at night before bed, or rock while you read a story. Maybe it is something that the parents just need to spend more time with just one child and kind of break up and divide all the other children. But we do try to give parents things they can work on at home, because obviously that the child's there far more than they are here.
Absolutely. So you've been doing this a long time.
Uh-huh.
And we had a global pandemic. I think we still have a global pandemic in some places, but there was definitely a shift, and I think everybody recognizes this, that there was a shift in what seemed to be predictable, what seemed to be certain. Things seem to be less secure, less predictable. There are a lot of people are struggling from economic difficulties and more challenges and so on. What have you noticed? How is that manifesting itself in the population, the young population that you see in Johnson County?
I think very similar to what we've seen in our coworkers as adults or our friends. Some children, it was very seamless for them to just go back to school and pick up sort of where they left off. Other children really struggle, and it became very difficult for some children to go back to regular classrooms. It became very difficult for children to predict anything because, you know, maybe their parents were home more. And that became a lifestyle that was positive or negative, depending on the situation. And what we have noticed is there has been a lot more anxiety, especially in very young children.
So how do you, you know, if you have a young child, how do you know whether you're seeing kind of normal developmental behavior, or how do you know whether it's an anxiety that you need to maybe pay some more attention to?
So one thing is, how much does it interrupt our lives? How much does it interrupt that child's life? Is that child so focused on worrying about the future that they can't be in the present right now? How much are they saying things, you know, like, what time is it? When do I do this? They become very clingy because they're unsure. And I think parents who have an intuitive sense will recognize that this seems more than it used to be. This seems like this is really bothering this child. And I think that that's sort of the tipping point. When it becomes more than just kind of a passing question or a passing focus, and it becomes where it's taking over that child's life more and more, then that's when we need to call in some help.
Okay. So one thing we haven't talked about but is very present, especially amongst our youth, is digital, the digital world, the virtual world, and the role of social media. And I think we're living at the beginning, or we're just living in an experiment right now. We have no idea what's going to happen. Most of us are stuck in some way or other to our cell phone or our computer and so on. That's likely to have a tremendous impact going forward, and we don't yet know whether it's going to be positive or negative, how it's going to correct or self-correct itself, but we're living in that. And again, that probably feeds into an uncertainty, but time and again you hear of adolescents and even teachers and other adults be concerned about the impact of social media. Do you see that a lot too?
Absolutely. Generally, we see a big move around fifth grade, sixth grade, and children become more connected to their phones, Snapchat, texting, and that's when a lot of the interactions, I believe we've seen, they really begin about that age, and then it seems like they escalate through middle school. And then high school can be very, very challenging with social media, and not just social media, but digitally, just texting back and forth. And the cruelties and the things that children and adolescents point out to each other, really hateful. Some things can be very hateful, very mean.
And it's so much easier, we know it's so much easier to say something when you're not in front of somebody, speaking to them face to face. You may well send something that you wouldn't say in that regard. But also, sometimes it's also open to interpretation, because words, you know, in a text format, whether it's on Snapchat or whatever, can be meant in one way and be interpreted completely differently because you're not hearing the nuance or the expression in the voice. And, you know, a joke or something which is intended to be funny, even if it's misguided, actually can be very cruel and hurtful. What do you think we can do about these problems?
Well, I think one thing that would be really helpful is if parents knew what was happening. Some parents are very vigilant about it, but things are still happening. That I think the key to it is if you can have a positive relationship with your child, where that child feels they can discuss things with you, you will learn a lot about what's happening in that child's life. And a lot of times kids will come to session with me and they will read texts, or they will have me read texts. And then we will talk about, well, how did you feel when you got this? And, you know, it depends on your background with that person and how stable you feel as a person. Like you said, there are so many components to it. But I think the number one thing is we just really need to build relationships with our children so they feel free to talk to us.
One of the things that came out of some of the presentations for The Right Road, which was the event that was held at the high school recently about basically safety, and a lot of it focused on driving, but on safety, was the presenter from DCI who came and talked about digital online safety for young people, and he did an adult presentation for parents too. One of the things that came out of that was basically, if your kid has an app, you should have that app, and you should ask them to show you how to run it, and then that opens a conversation for kind of what is happening, so you don't just sit your kid down and say, so tell me what's happening in your life. probably not going to be very forthcoming, but that if you can discuss over the app and you can ask them why it's an important app to have and so on, that that can be a nice way of kind of opening those relationships.
I think that's a great idea. And one thing that we have experienced quite a lot is parents get really frustrated and then just say, I'm taking the phone, you don't have a phone. And the child or the adolescent especially doesn't learn how to manage those things. And the other thing we see all the time is somebody always has another phone, they get loaned another phone. And so I think just getting rid of it altogether is not the answer.
So do you have some observations if you were able to be in every parent's home, what are your observations about good phone controls? What do you recommend and suggest?
Well, I think it's very important that at night the phone goes to bed. I think we see a lot of kids who will chat all night long with different friends who are awake or wake them up because they're sleeping with their phone. And so a lot of teens especially who engage in that all-night behavior just aren't getting enough rest. But I think it's a great idea to have a charging station, and at a certain time of night when it's getting time to go to bed, that the phone goes to bed as well. And that may have to be in the parent's bedroom or someplace where then the phone doesn't get re-engaged.
Walk away.
Well, yeah, well, just walk
just
away.
Just walk away. Just walk away. Thanks. That's really helpful. So, when do you open up in down on Main Street in your other office?
Well, there has been an extensive remodeling in there. Marcia and Luke Goddard have done an amazing job. And so it will have a very different look. I know a lot of us probably spent many hours in Greg Goddard's office over the years, but it will have a new, very bright look. And we should be open for business on Monday or Tuesday,
well,
November 1st.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And how do people get hold of you if they want to connect as a client or they just want to find out more?
So they can certainly go to our website, which is counselingandplay.com. And there's all kinds of contact information on there. They can contact me by Googling me and my name and number and Jamie's name and number is right on the front of our office here across from the post office. We will be working on a sign in front of Goddard's office this winter, but they can certainly contact us in any of those ways. And we have, now that we have a second playroom going in at the Goddard building, and I have hired, in addition to Stephanie Adelsky and Shaney McRae, I have hired Tempe McStay and Adelaide Wilson. So those four clinicians will be up at the Goddard office.
And are you going to go on calling it the Goddard office, or are you going to give it a new name?
It will have my same name, the Counseling and Play Therapy Center.
Okay, so it will be the Counseling and Play Therapy Center at the other end of Main Street.
Yes, at 412 North Main. Okay. So we'll have a North Main and a South Main office.
Well, Rose Harriet, thank you so very much for spending some time and telling me all about the wonderful play therapy that you put on in this community. Thank you.
Thank you.